As you're arriving, what we're going to be clearly asking you to do right now is to let us know what you noticed, discovered, found challenging, found enlightening about the empathy meditation. And if Michelle and David would be ready with the microphones, that would be helpful. Great. So anyone that would like to share, David, there's somebody right down in front of you.
It's always what's right in front of you. It's hard to see. And that was what I got out of the empathy exercise with my husband. And what was hardest and most enlightening was to shut off everything I know about him. And as I was listening, I mean, it was so good that you said right beforehand, the I don't know mind.
Yeah.
'Cause I'm like, okay, I think I can do this. Instead of listening to his words as I normally would and going back and kind of judging it and testing it over the 15 years we've been together, I listened to him and this incredible compassion came over me. I was able to see his struggle instead of just seeing that he was annoying. and feel how much he was trying to balance the needs of, you know, brothers, sisters, mothers, me, his children, and his life. How wonderful he is. And usually I would not have been more on the annoying end of the scale than the wonderful. So that was very good practice for me.
So just to say, this is like a perfect example of the gift to us of practicing empathy. It's more of an undoing than a doing. We're undoing our habitual way of interpreting and opening up the filter to find out what's real. And the gift, what's real, is really sacred and beautiful. Thank you for that. So others. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about the difference between compassion and empathy?
I'll say briefly the way I am. I think of this capacity for empathy as the ground of compassion. In other words, there is abstract compassion, which is I care about the suffering of the world, but there's not really a visceral sense. And then there is this awake presence that attunes and actually in a feeling, felt sense way, feels and resonates with the suffering. And then the I care comes from that empathy. So empathy actually creates an activity of compassion that you actually respond versus an abstract compassion.
In addition to that, building really on it, compassion has a intentional quality. You know, technically it's the wish that others not suffer. So, in other words, empathy moves to action. It's interesting, just a detail, one of the studies on monks in the MRI scanner, they were asked to focus on compassion, which they did, but what also lit up were the premotor cortex or cortices, in other words, the part of the brain that's getting ready to initiate an action. You see? In other words, moving their heart by compassion was readying their brain to take action.
I spent 40 years as a diplomat, so I'm very good at remembering what people say. So with my wife, I did a very good job of giving back to her exactly what she said without the slightest feeling. And God bless her, she said to me, well, now, why don't you put your hand on your heart? At which point, I finally got in touch with the emotional side of it. So the lesson for me is get out of my head and into my heart.
And I just want to add that what I said is the words you're saying feel right. I mean, are right, but I don't feel felt. And you need to put your hand on your heart. It really made a huge difference.
I love that language, I don't feel felt, because we need to be received in a felt sense way. We need that. Thank you.
As the listener, during part of our exercise, I was struck by the ability to know almost with certainty the couple of emotions that I felt. coming through from Jim. But then as I kept trying to look further and further, I realized that at other times I really wasn't sure if what I had seen was really there or not. So it was good to know that you might feel like when you're really trying your hardest to put that empathy out there, that you're still maybe seeing things through your own filter, and you can't be sure that what you're experiencing is really there.
Beautiful. So this is the next step of training then, which is that humility of knowing we're not sure, that uncertainty is what then propels you to say, you know, I'm guessing this, but is that how it is? Nobody is offended by a guess when it comes out of that kind of humility and interest. So don't be afraid to make a wrong guess. That's an invitation. That's like telling somebody you want to know about them. Go ahead and try it out on them. Yeah, thank you. Okay, maybe just one more.
I've really been enjoying having the two of you together. Kind of it's the yin and the yang for me, the male and female perspective sometimes. I've seen it come out in discussion, and it came out for me in talking with my wife and listening to my wife. When she was speaking and I was a listener, and she was talking about something that I could see was affecting her, and what I wanted to do was then to, in my head, I started thinking, well, how might she address this? What action can she take? Or could I help her take? And then I stepped back and I said, okay, that's a male kind of tendency. I feel like I'm in the Deborah Tannen exercise here, but maybe let me just try to stay with the emotion that she's feeling and feel that, because my question earlier was, what is bodily resonance? And that was what I was trying to work on. You know, it's like to see her emotion and feel that emotion and not try the solution.
Thank you.
I had a comment on a question that Karen asked me at the break, which was, she said, well, what about the pause before the pause? And if I understood her question, it is basically, if the pause is defined as we're reacting, but we notice we're reacting, we're not acting out our reaction, and we're starting to reflect on our reaction. You know, we're being with it and probably also starting to work with it. Okay. What about the pause before that pause when, if I understand you, we're not actually having a reaction at all? My wife sends me an email and I don't react to it. Or something happens in your life and there just isn't that reaction. It's a great question, isn't it, really? And I have a couple of comments about it. The first is to really appreciate, honestly, this side of complete awakening. We're going to be upset. Right? We're going to get upset. We're going to have stuff come up. We're reactive animals. I said to some people at the first break that there's a lot about practice that swims upstream against the river of evolution. We evolved to be reactive, aggressive, cranky characters, you know, at the top of the food chain, and not present, distractible, alert, vigilant, and edgy. There's a lot about practice that tames those tendencies. There's a lot about practice that draws on, thank goodness, other heritages of evolution that are pro practice. But the point is, it's useful, I think, to be realistic and compassionate about sort of the endlessness. It's like a little bit of a variant on the Bodhisattva vow. Upsets are endless. I vow to transcend them all. You know? So that's part one. Part two, for me, it's useful to track stages of growth. Because it can be daunting sometimes, and we feel helpless, and as I said at the beginning, one thing that has really motivated me is a sense of efficacy. There's a sense that we can do something about these afflictive states of mind that harm ourselves and really harm other people as well. And so I want to tell you a very cool model of growth. It comes from education, but it's also in other things. It's like four stages. So when you first encounter something, there's unconscious incompetence. You're a little kid, you don't know about bikes, and you cannot ride a bike. Okay? Or you're getting upset and reactive, and you don't even know you're getting upset and reactive. You're unconscious and incompetent. Stage two is conscious incompetence. You know about bikes, you're trying to ride the bike, and you're falling over. Or, in personal growth, you're reacting, you're acting it out, you know you're doing it. There's kind of a horrified 1% of you running behind the parade going, "Stop!" But it's too late. Ba-boom. That ship is pulled away from the dock. It's fully on, right? The Death Star is loaded and fully operational. Okay, that's the second stage. Third stage, conscious competence. The transition from the second to the third stage is really the art of practice, where we become consciously competent. We know about riding a bike. We're riding the bike, but we're paying a lot of attention to riding the bike. Conscious competence. Or a reaction arises, the tendency to act on it arises, but we don't act it out. That's conscious competence. And then the fourth stage is the pause before the pause, where it's unconscious competence. We ride a bike automatically or emotionally. The reactive tendency doesn't even arise. And very often we kind of forget it happened. I think a lot of times in life we're having the pause before the pause or this fourth stage, and we don't even notice it because we're just not getting reactive, right? So a lot of practice is the gradual movement through the stages to the fourth stage. The second stage is the worst. That's where people often quit, right? They're getting reactive. They hate themselves for getting reactive, and they can't stop getting reactive, right? It's horrible. Hang in there with the second stage, because the third stage will really develop over time. The last thing I want to say is that one thing that I think really, two things really cultivate, preventive non-reactivity. One is to try to keep the body fairly calm and cultivate tranquility and calm and peace in the body, because the body is what reacts. Okay, the body is reactive. And the second thing is to really open up to the teachings around not-self, to have to have less and less selfing, because selfing sets us up to react to the slings and arrows, you know, the first darts of outrageous fortune. But by focusing more broadly on taking things less personally, realizing that all kinds of other people are affected by all kinds of things, not selfing, in other words, that's a great way to move more and to live more in the pause before the pause. Okay? All right. So I want to talk about the evolution of love. All right? Okay? This is actually a lot of amazingly wonderful material that I'm going to just summarize, because it's not that hard to summarize. It's really straightforward. Here's the thing. The central point here is that love drove the evolution of the brain. Now, I mean love very broadly. I mean love as relatedness, sociability, empathy, bonding, and so forth. It did so in three major stages. In other words, there's a lot of controversy. Why did the brain become bigger? You know, 2.5 million years ago, the brains of people like us making stone tools, third our size. The brain has tripled in size over the last 2.5 million years. That's incredible from an evolutionary standpoint. What drove it, let alone what has driven the evolution of the brain over 100 million years? One theory is that it's been like a big arms race. You know, who's going to be the best at killing? Or who's going to be the best at tool using? But actually, the latest science, and there's a lot of science here, is that it's really who's the best at loving, broadly defined. It happened in three big jumps. First jump is when you think of the contrast between mammals and birds compared to reptiles and fish. All right? Proportionate to body weight, mammals and birds have bigger brains than reptiles and fish. What's the one thing that mammals and birds do that reptiles and fish don't do? That's right. They pair bond and raise young. They raise their young. Fish will eat their young. They don't even recognize them. Sometimes reptiles will too. All right. Whereas mammals and birds pair bond and raise young together. You know, the computational requirements, so-called, of choosing a good mate, keeping it together with your mate, raising those kids, hanging in there, working out who does what, who does the dishes, you know, all that sort of parenting stuff, you need a bigger brain. That was the first big jump in the evolution of the brain. Really. Then second big jump, primates. Primates, probably about 40 million years of primate evolution. The larger the social group, or the more, and especially the more social the primate group, the bigger the brain to body size. Why is that? Primates have all these alliances. They're intensely social. You know, who's on top, who's on the bottom, who grooms whom. One of the favorite primate research datums that I like is that they actually found, first of all, that primates will spend maybe a sixth of their time grooming each other. The second thing is you have these groomers and groomies, right? So these scientists, of course, they would anesthetize the primates after they groomed each other and draw cortisol from their blood to see who had more cortisol as a marker of stress. Okay? So, in other words, I'll say it like this. Who do you think was less stressed, the groomer or the groomee? The groomer, exactly. It's counterintuitive. You knew my strategy because, oh, I said it up there. Damn. The answer's up there. Okay. Yeah, so I say that to my wife. Honey, you're going to get a stress relief benefit. Scratch my head. Doesn't work. She's too smart to see through my tricks. But anyway, that's kind of cool. So that's another major jump in the evolution of the brain, these intensely social primate groups. And then last came human beings, where there's a lot of evolution, and that shows that it made sense to altruistically cooperate with us within a hunter-gatherer breeding group, a band, in very lethal environments, you know, with a lot of intensity around survival and keeping it together. It makes a lot of sense to altruistically cooperate with us. And the bands that were better at teamwork outcompeted bands that did not have good teamwork. And there's some very neat studies of this where very small differences in teamwork or relational capacity accumulates over time. And with that came a lot of other things that relate that foster relationships, like theories of justice and fairness, or concern about reputation. Because if you have a hunter-gatherer band and no one knows whether you pay back someone who gave you a banana today, right, there's no benefit in being altruistic. But if you're in a group where your generosity is noticed, and if you don't respond to generosity later, you're not going to succeed so much in survival. So we really evolved to care a lot about our reputation. Okay? So that was really a dramatic basis in three major steps of the evolution of the brain. It's really interesting to think that for all the attention that war and conflict gets, one of the main things, probably the primary force in our capacity to sit here and think and intellectualize and have a room with organs and glass and sound systems has been driven by love. It's been driven by empathy, friendship, bonding, cooperation, and altruism. That's pretty great, I think. So, now, brain in lust and love. So, if you want to keep, I'll just do it like this. So, now, when we see someone we're infatuated with, the reward centers of the brain really light up. On the other side of it, if we see someone that, if we reject it, the same pain centers in the brain that react to physical pain tend to react as well. It literally feels awful. I mean, honestly, which would you rather have? Someone hit your thumb with a hammer or be cast out of an important group? A lot of us would pick the hammer, you know. It really hurts to be cast out and rejected. Interestingly, lust, you know, in the beginning of courting, I'll show you a picture in a second, activates the hypothalamus, these major drive states, and amygdala. So, of course, we want to go courting. But over time, the rewards tend to get more diffuse for a lot of people. On the other hand, this is a picture. Remember I said earlier the nuns, the caudate nucleus, it's a reward center of the brain. This same center lights up, as I said earlier, when undergrads are looking at who are in love, are looking at a photograph of their sweetheart while they're in the MRI scanner. That's what this center is here. This is a slice of the brain in this axis, like this. Okay, and you're looking right down into the middle where the key reward centers of the brain are. And that part of the brain is lighting up in the same way it would with cocaine and with winning a big lottery. Now, the interesting thing, which I really love because I've been married 27 years now, is that some couples who are in long-term stable relationships still get that pleasure circuit tickle when they look at the picture of their mate. And I think that's just kind of good. I'm a Buddhist kind of guy, but I still think that form of reward and pleasure is a really good thing. Okay. So, now what's the result of all this really groovy, you know, rewards of love and bonding and hypothalamus drives? It's grandchildren. Grandchildren rock. In a breeding group where people are together, grandparents, especially grandmothers, are really, really useful. Because grandmothers, especially, and to some extent grandfathers, if you think about it, in a primitive group where people die when they're 40, you know, 45 typically, yet they're having children starting around age 15 or 16, grandfathers aren't going to be that helpful in bringing calories into the band through hunting, because they're going to be, you know, more wiped out physically. But grandmothers who can tend to babies while their mothers go out and gather, they're going to increase the reproductive success of the family. That's a personal theory as to why women have a longer lifespan than men, in part, if you think about it, because there's a survival payoff in having grandmothers. But the genetic transfer that, you know, we really care about is multi-generational. It's grandchildren. So that's the result of all this incredibly wonderful hardware. Now, if you have children, as we evolved and had a bigger brain, childhood got longer and longer and longer. But to be able to take care of these kids who have a long childhood, humans have the longest childhood of any species on the planet, right? We've got a lot to learn. Kids are really vulnerable. They need a village it takes to raise a child. How do you keep that village bonded together? One of the main ways of doing that was through oxytocin. I knew we couldn't do the neurodharma of love without talking about oxytocin. Men have oxytocin too. All right, I just want to claim that. Women have testosterone. Men have oxytocin. Women have a lot more oxytocin than men do. It promotes bonding in general, in both males and females, mothers and children in particular. It's very involved in breastfeeding to give a sense of its sort of oceanic quality. In both men and women, it dampens stress. There's been a lot of neat research, you may have heard it, about tending and befriending as a response of human females to stressors. A lot of that involves increases of oxytocin, which bring down cortisol in the sympathetic nervous system and calm things down. But it's also true for men. I think men get a little bit of a bad rap as not seeming relational. But you think of the ways in which men bond and do things together athletically or in teamwork kinds of modes, there's a lot of tending and befriending that's happening there. It's just in guy style. What's up? What do you think about the Lakers? You know, that's the guy style. Man, I feel close to you already, man. It's awesome. We're like this, you know. So yeah, it's just different style, but the result is the same. So oxytocin is triggered by bonding behaviors. It's triggered by all kinds of other stuff. It's really triggered by orgasm. That's one reason why sex is good, you know, with the right people at least. Post-coital, you know, that kind of closeness feeling is a lot related to oxytocin releases. Moving closely with other people releases oxytocin, as does the imagination of any of these. Okay? So we have all this fantastic hardware, which is really great, and I want to do a little micro exercise of oxytocin. Take just a couple minutes. So hand on your heart again, if you will. Okay, hand on your heart. Bring to mind someone you feel really close to. It could be a pet, by the way. It could be a pet. A lot of people feel very close to pets. Someone you feel very close to, maybe someone in the room, maybe not. And really encourage, work with, that sense of closeness and caring, you know, you feel with them. How about we all say it together? Well, okay, we can stop now. I guarantee you there's more oxytocin in your blood right now than there was 2 minutes ago. I want to say one last little thing, I only told you half of the story. The other half of the story, besides the evolution of altruistic cooperation with us, is fearful aggression toward them. And as soon as we define an us and a them, we tend to start mobilizing the devaluation and the dehumanizing of them. And that also is very much in our evolution. Now, there's a lot of evidence that cooperation with us is primary. Aggression toward them gets a lot of press. It's a lot of action. But most of the human story is this tapestry of everyday cooperation with people close to us and including with strangers, casual cooperation with strangers. That said, we're very quickly driven from that baseline by the drums of war, you know, writ large and writ small. And that's the challenge here that Tara's going to talk about.
Was I going to talk about that? Yeah, okay.
How to widen the circles of us to include them.
You know, I think one of the most interesting inquiries is about, you know, evolution and where's it going and what's happening to consciousness. And how many of you believe that consciousness is evolving? How many of you actually think, yeah, there's a lot of spirituality around, but that's not the direction, the vector? How many of you don't know? Don't know is good. So whether or not we don't, you know, conceptually know what's true, there's something that I encounter with many, many people, which is there is some sense within us, some sincerity that finds a beauty and a homecoming in widening the circles, that we are more feeling whole and happy in who we are when more and more beings are included in our hearts. And that when we feel separation or blame, the biochemistry of that is familiar, but it doesn't feel like home. So what does widening the circles mean? One little story I've always loved is of a tired-looking dog wandering into the yard, and this woman says, "I could tell from his collar, though no tags, and well-fed belly, and the fact he was clean, he had a home. He followed me onto the couch, into the house, down the hall, and fell asleep on the couch." Now, my dogs didn't seem to mind. He seemed like a good dog, and I was okay with him, so I let him nap. An hour later, he went to the door, and I let him out. Next day, he was back, resumed his position on the couch, and slept for an hour. This continued for several weeks. Curious, I pinned a note to his collar, and I wrote, "Every afternoon, your dog comes to my house for a nap. I don't mind, but I want to make sure it's okay with you." The next day, he arrived with a different note pinned to his collar. "He lives in a home with three children. He's trying to catch up on his sleep. May I come with him tomorrow?" You know. So there's a sense of, you know, we know what it's like, whether it's for a dog or for another human. One of my favorite studies of that was so revealing about chimps was of, you know, they've known for a long, long time that chimps deprived of a mother die, they languish and die. But what was more recent was when a mother was distracted regularly and not able to, you know, not necessarily able to count on when she was getting her food, there was not much bonding, and the chimp babies would grow up, and it was correlated with the chemistry, but depressed, anxious, binge eaters, and unable to be social. We know it. We know it that when there's not a sense of connectedness, when there's not a sense of connectedness with others around us, when we're not connected in our own being, that there's dis-ease, that we don't make it. So the inquiry really on the spiritual path is how do we be intentional about widening these circles of compassion? How do we, in the places where we contract and create an other, how do in those moments we care more about love than we do about being right? So quickly, just check in and sense, where is there a place in your life? Where is there a place in your life right now where, as Rick described it, the conditioning towards creating an other is strong enough that you feel some separation? Where is there a place in your life where there's some sense of really wanting to push away, judge, blame? And sense the intention to let this place be part of the grounds of your awakening. The places that most serve our awakening are where we bring our mindfulness to reactivity. The Bodhisattva language, the aspiration is, may this serve the awakening of compassion. And as we're exploring today, empathy and compassion. Now there's two trainings that begin to free us in that direction. Very specific ways of paying attention that Rick has touched on some and that we're going to just end the day with. And one of the trainings is to be able to, in those places where there is the old conditioning, to react, the us and them. The first is to see the vulnerability. And we've been building towards this through the day. Can you see your own vulnerability in that moment? And can you begin to look at the other and see the others? That's one of the trainings. And this is the considered the training karuna. And then there's the training in loving kindness, which is, can you see the innate goodness? Can you respond to the goodness that's in a being? I want to share a story that to me is a story about widening the circles, and then we're going to do an exercise. And I love this story because it happened in Washington, D.C., and this is a man who worked with juvenile offenders here, and most were gang members who committed homicide. And it's particularly relevant right now because it's summer break and there's a lot more gang activity, and there's just so much violence, and what's the possible reaction or response? And in one particular situation, a 14-year-old had shot and killed an innocent teen to prove himself to a gang. And during the trial, the victim's mother sat impassively silent until the end when the youth was convicted of the killing. And after the verdict was announced, she stood up slowly and stared directly at him and stated, "I'm going to kill you." Then the youth was taken away to serve several years in the facility, juvenile facility. After 6 months, the mother of the slain child went to jail and visited his killer. And he had been living on the streets before the killing, and she was the only visitor he had. So for a time they talked, and when she left him money for cigarettes, snacks. And then she started to visit more regularly this boy that had killed her son, bringing him food and small gifts. She just asked him how he's doing and listened. And nearly at the end of his 3-year sentence, she asked him what he'd be doing when he got out, and he was confused and very uncertain. So she offered him to set him up with a job at a friend's company. And then she inquired about where he'd live, and since he had no family to return to, she offered him temporary use of the spare room in her home. For 8 months, he lived there, ate her food, worked at the job, and then one evening she called him into the living room to talk. She sat down opposite him and took time for a long pause. "Do you remember in the courtroom when I said I was going to kill you?" "I sure do," he replied. "Well, I did," she went on. She said, "I did not want the boy who would kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. I wanted him to die. That's why I started to visit you and bring you things, to talk, to listen, to get you a job, to let you live here. And that's how I set about changing you. And that old boy, he's gone. So now what I want to ask you, since my son is gone and that killer is gone, if you'll stay here. I've got room and I'd like to adopt you if you let me." And she became the mother of her son's killer, the mother he had never had. Now, there's a reason I shared this story with you at kind of the end of a day like today. We have an amazing potential within us. And I want to say honestly, I don't know how I would respond if somebody killed my son. I can't say I could do that. And I don't think what matters is that we have some heroic ideal, but that we begin to sense our capacity, this capacity for empathy and for widening the circles to include, without exception, all beings. That's the potential that we have, the equipment within us, should we pay attention, should we care enough to pay attention. And it frees our own hearts. This isn't about being a good person and being good to others. This is about the freedom of our own hearts. The training is, can we see the vulnerability that's there, and can we see the goodness? Somehow this woman could see past the mask and past the behaviors that had totally ripped up her own heart to see the potential, the intrinsic goodness. She had had that capacity. We can train that. And here's the beauty, that when we see it in another, we invite it out. That's the gift that we offer each other. That when we can pause and really undo our normal reactivity and in a deep way look, the eyes that are looking back at us are a mystery. That in those eyes and looking through those eyes is love and is awareness. And if we can see that, we can actually call it forward into its full manifestation. So it's in that spirit we're going to be practicing an exercise or a meditation, which is really on learning to see each other, but we'll do it in silence this time. And so please, if you will, to stay quiet and to stand up and move around the room and find yourself a partner and then sit down and spread out as we did before, okay? But really quietly. We want to stay really connected to our own inner life. Okay, this is an easy meditation because I'm going to walk you through the whole thing. But sit close enough so you're able to look at each other. Okay, so take a few full breaths and notice, if you'd like to close your eyes for a moment, just let your attention go inward and notice if it's possible just to let go a little right now. To, in this pause, just relax your body, relax your heart. And as you're relaxing, even though it's really natural to feel a kind of awkwardness in this, for some people, it's fine. Just open your eyes and stay silent. And this is a time that you are looking at each other. And continue breathing and just centering yourself and exhaling tension. And as I mentioned, if you feel discomfort as you're looking at each other, because we're not so used to in this culture, or an urge to laugh or look away, just note that. Just be mindful of it and be gentle with yourself. Just to know that you may never see this person again, and this is an opportunity to behold the uniqueness and the mystery and the spirit of this particular human being. So as you look into this being's eyes, let yourself be aware of the powers that are there. In other words, open yourself to the gifts and the strengths and the potentials in this being. With an interest, sensing that behind those eyes are unmeasured reserves of wisdom and kindness, creativity, humor. So that just to open to the goodness, the heart, that and that person that really seeks to know truth and to be awake. Sensing the untapped powers here and how they can really serve the healing of our earth. This being, this being's love. So that as you sense the goodness that's here, become aware of your desire that this person be free from fear, free from sorrow, that this person experience true happiness, and as you feel that wish, that prayer for this person, what you're experiencing is loving kindness. Continuing to look into these eyes and being aware also of the pain or the vulnerability that's here. There are sorrows accumulated in this life's journey. in all life journeys, failures, losses. You might sense the griefs or the disappointments beyond words that are behind those eyes. And to let yourself open to them, to open to that pain, to the hurts that this person may never have shared with another. And letting yourself be touched, empathically touched, know that this is really the essence of compassion, necessary for the healing of our world. As you look into these eyes, sense the goodness of how you could join together and work for the healing of this world. How your energies, your passions, your cares, whether it's together in a physical way or just part of the field of healing energy, sensing the joy in serving healing, in celebrating beauty, that's part of your shared beingness, that joy, that gratitude. How inherent in this person is this capacity for joy, for loving love, loving life. And know that this is the expression of heart described as joy. And lastly now, let your awareness drop deep. Deep within you, like a stone sinking below the level of words. Let your breath be deep and quiet. And open your consciousness to the deep web of relationship that underlies and interweaves all experiencing, all knowing. It is the web of life in which you've taken being and in which you are supported. Out of that vast web, you cannot fall. No failure, no inadequacy can sever you from this living web. For this is what you are. This is what has brought you into being. Relaxing and feeling the assurance of this belonging. Feel the great peace. Rest in it. Out of that knowing, that peace, that freedom of equanimity, we have the courage to venture everything. We can trust and we can act. And gently now closing your eyes. And as you do, sensing the field of loving presence that is the source of you and your partner. That is a source of all the life forms and beings here in this room and everywhere. Knowing this loving presence as your true refuge, your true home. please take a few moments to thank your partner, to say whatever feels right to say, and then let's come back for our closing as a group. Okay, let's come back together, and we'll just, for the last time, we're going to be inviting a bit of sharing what that was like for you. And I'd like to see if there's somebody that has not spoken today that feels inclined to have your voice in the room, to please feel free. I would just like to encourage that. So anybody, what was that like for you?
Anyway, I thought it was hard to do. I'm not used to looking at somebody that long and staring at them. And it just felt, I felt very intimate, but it was very hard.
Yeah.
It was anxiety producing. It was nice, but it was just a closeness that was hard.
So could you all hear that? Very intimate, very difficult. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I agree that it was difficult, but at a certain point I began to... I have a memory. I had an aunt who lived with us, and she was almost more like a mother to me. And I have a real memory of looking in her face and being very aware of everything about her. And she had a wonderful smile and very alive eyes. But I had the feeling, looking at Caroline after a while, I'm really looking at her face the way I used to look at my aunt's face or maybe my mother's face when I was very little, and that maybe I've given that up. Mm. I don't look at people as deeply as I did as a child.
Mm. So it gave you a taste of the possibility of looking at a much deeper level.
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
I had two things to talk about. The first is I'm here with my wife, and I guess it's kind of taking her for granted that we've been together for... We don't look at each other like that for that long of a period of time, or I certainly look at her with that type of intention. There'll be brief snippets of it, but to do it for that long was something that maybe we've never done. And the other comment is that there's a real physical component that inhibits my practice, because when I get tired or I have too much caffeine, which I tend to do, I understand what I need to do, but the ability to actually do it, and that's what happened at the end here. I just got really tired, and I lied to her. I did almost fall asleep. I was sitting there, I was breathing deep, and I just got really comfortable. My eyes, I could have nodded out, and I brought myself back. But the intention was lost because the tiredness set in.
Which happens. I mean, it's like we can guide this meditation and that, and there's going to be all 10,000 different states of mind that you're going to bring to it. And the hope is that you're getting a sense of what you can deepen and explore over time, because it's been a long day. Yeah, so...
Right there? I found that with my partner, it was interesting because I'd never met her before. And at first I was nervous, but after I relaxed, I felt an energy of our connection. And when we closed my eyes, it wasn't as strong. So, I mean, it was just profound for me. Like, I felt that there was an energy in connecting with somebody, and just, even if it was a perfect stranger, just connecting with somebody and looking them in the eye.
Yeah, it's especially amazing that when it's a perfect stranger that you can stop and be with and have that connection. That's great. Yeah.
I was also with a perfect stranger. I don't know that I've ever looked in anyone's eyes for that long before. How long was it?
I'm not sure. An hour and 20 minutes.
But I didn't find it difficult. I found it a kind of mystical quality to it or something, but I didn't find it difficult. And I thought I would at first. I found it very pleasurable, actually.
Thank you.
I did it with someone I didn't know, a stranger, and I guess was kind of compassionate because I could notice that they were nervous and they would laugh periodically and they sound distracted, and I just stared at them for a while, and then eventually, I don't know, maybe that made them nervous. And then they finally kind of settled in, and I could tell they were calmer. And so I kind of felt for them in the beginning. And then I guess then we were able to do the exercise better because they weren't so distracted, because that distracted me from connecting with them.
And so this is just to name that the first level that goes on in something like this is we see all our habitual ways of either staring at or being defended towards or nervous, or because it's so not part of our culture to be intimate in that way with each other. And then what's possible once that starts falling away is that instead of us staring at, we begin to see past the mask of who's there, and we begin to be seen in a way. So the invitation here is not to that you go out on the streets and you start, you know, unless you want somebody to get really weird with you. But more, it's an intention to look more deeply at who's here. Because in the moments that you look to see who's here, you begin to sense that the one that's looking out at you is no different than who's looking through these eyes. You begin to wake up out of this trance of separateness, which in my sense of things is really the direction of all of evolution, is that awareness comes to realize itself through these bodies and hearts. So I because of the timing, I want to, you know, we're not going to take any more questions, but we'll just be closing in a few moments. And Rick, I want to just turn to you and see if there's anything you'd like to say in closing.
Well, I felt enormously welcomed here, and I really want to thank you as an emissary from Spirit Rock Meditation Center, my home center in Northern California. And Tara Brach is someone I should have said actually has been a teacher for me personally, someone that I esteem enormously and hold in my heart as one of my own personal benefactors in terms of loving kindness. So I'm proud of you. Mm-hmm. And in closing, I had a thought that I've observed that one thing that gets in the way of us being able to be really present with other people is we have doubts about our own goodness. We don't really trust or have faith in our own natural goodness, deep down goodness. And that really gets in the way. And so first thing I want to say to you is, not because I know you personally, but because I trust the Dharma and what it says about people, it's that I know that each one of us deep down is good. Every person deep down is good. You're good deep down. And one way that becomes very realized is through giving love. Personal story, when I was 23 or so, I got Rolfed. Rolfing, as you may know, is a form of deep tissue body work. As it turned out, we had the Rolfer we traded with. We gave her space in our house, and she would, in exchange, Rolf us. So we would be sitting in the living room hearing her work in the front room, and Rolfing was then particularly quite deep and painful, and we hear people screaming, "Stop, Mira, stop, please stop." And they're like, "You're waiting for your appointment, okay?" Pretty scary. So it's sequential, and she was coming up to the fifth session for me, which is a session on the gut. And I knew that I'd repressed a lot of negative emotion growing up in my own home, and I thought, oh my God, this is going to be like a big barf fest of negativity, right? Oh my God. I was like, okay, go for it. And so I go in to do the session, and Mira was a very not etheric kind of person at all, very, very grounded. She was there to pound out the dents in the chassis, you know, that was what she was there to do. So she starts working on my gut, and then there's this transforming kind of thing that starts to happen. She goes, whoa. She goes to the end of the table, and I felt it and she felt it. It was like a searchlight of love coming out of my gut. That's what I'd really repressed as a kid. In my war with my parents, I'd really repressed my love. And I think that's very often what people withhold. We withhold love, and that's the great wound. That's the great suffering, is the withholding of love. And so as the Buddha says, and as you can see in this sutta here, love itself is a profound spiritual practice. You know, love that is for includes being for ourselves. Love that includes appropriate assertiveness and boundaries and all the rest of that. But fundamentally, love that omits none. Omits none. Put them out of your house. Put them out of your job. Put them out of your bedroom, maybe. But never put them out of your heart. And that practice is a whole practice. And as you've probably experienced, by being loving, that really fuels, and feeds and protects us ourselves. So may you really enjoy the practice of love and be ever more loving. So, and again, I really thank you. I feel very grateful for being here.
I just want to add my gratitude. I want to thank you, Rick. I feel like what you're bringing in, the vitality of the science and your wisdom and your heart is just a real gift to our community. So I'm really, really grateful, and I bow to you. And to all of you, I could feel through this day, and it feels visceral, a field that gets created when people come together and there's sincerity. And your willingness to engage in these kind of practices, which some can feel awkward or intense or this or that, but your way of being, you've just been a wonderful group. And I really, again, I just want to bow to each of you for coming and what you bring to this. So thank you.